This is Audible.
Penguin Audio presents Small Favor by Jim Butcher, read by James Marsters. Chapter 1. Winter came early that year. It should have been a tip-off. A snowball soared through the evening air and smacked into my apprentice's mouth. Since she was muttering a mantra-style chant when it hit her, she wound up with a mouthful of frozen cheer, which may or may not have been more startling for her than for most people, given how many metallic piercings were suddenly in direct contact with the snow. Molly Carpenter sputtered, spitting snow, and a round of hooting laughter went up from the children gathered around her. Tall, blonde, and athletic, dressed in jeans and a heavy winter coat, she looked natural in the snowy setting, her cheeks and nose turning red with the cold. "Concentration, Molly," I called. I carefully kept any laughter I might have wanted to indulge in from my voice. "You've got to concentrate. Again." The children, her younger brothers and sisters, immediately began packing fresh ammunition to hurl at her. The backyard of the Carpenter house was already thoroughly chewed up from an evening of winter warfare, and two low fortress walls faced each other across 10 yards of open lawn. Molly stood between them, shivering, and gave me an impatient look. "This can't possibly be real training," she said, her voice quavering with cold. "You're just doing this for your own sick amusement, Harry." I beamed at her and accepted a freshly made snowball from Little Hope, who had apparently appointed herself my squire. I thanked the small girl gravely and bounced the snowball on my palm a few times. "Nonsense," I said. "This is wonderful practice. Did you think you were going to start off bouncing bullets?" Molly gave me an exasperated look. Then she took a deep breath, bowed her head, and lifted her left hand, her fingers spread wide. She began muttering again, and I felt the subtle shift of energies moving as she began drawing magic up around her in an almost solid barrier, a shield that rose between her and the incipient missile storm.
"Ready?"
I called out.
"Aim!"
Every single person there, including myself, threw before I got to the end of aim, and snowballs sped through the air, flung by children ranging from the eldest, Daniel, who was 17, down to the youngest, little Harry, who wasn't yet big enough to have much of a throwing arm, but who didn't let that stop him from making the largest snowball he could lift. Snowballs pelted my apprentice's shield, and it stopped the first two, the frozen missiles exploding into puffs of fresh powder. The rest of them, though, went right on through Molly's defenses, and she was splattered with several pounds of snow. Little Harry ran up to her and threw last with both hands and shrieked merry triumph as his bread loaf-sized snowball splattered all over Molly's stomach.
"Fire!" I barked belatedly.
Molly fell onto her butt in the snow, sputtered some more, and burst out in a long belly laugh. Harry and Hope, the youngest of the children, promptly jumped on top of her, and from there the lesson in defensive magic devolved into the Carpenter children's long-standing tradition of attempting to shovel as much snow as possible down the necks of one another's coats. I grinned and stood there watching them, and a moment later found the children's mother standing beside me. Molly took after Charity Carpenter, who had passed her coloring and build on to her daughter. Charity and I haven't always seen eye to eye. Well, in point of fact, we've hardly ever seen eye to eye. But tonight she was smiling at the children's antics.
"Good evening, Mr. Dresden," she murmured.
"Charity," I replied amiably. "This happen a lot?"
"Almost always, during the first real snowfall of the year," she said. "Generally, though, it's closer to Christmas than Halloween." I watched the children romping.
Though Molly was growing quickly in a number of senses, she reverted to childhood easily enough here, and it did me good to see it. I sensed Charity's unusually intense regard and glanced at her, lifting an eyebrow in question.
"You never had a snowball fight with family," she said quietly, "did you?"
I shook my head and turned my attention back to the kids.
"No family to have the fight with," I said.
Sometimes the kids would try at school, but the teachers wouldn't let it happen. And a lot of times the other kids did it to be mean instead of to have fun.
That changes things. Charity nodded and also looked back at the kids. My daughter, how is her training progressing?
Well, I think, I said.
Her talents don't lie anywhere close to the same area as mine do, and she's never going to be much of a combat wizard.
Charity frowned.
Why do you say that? Do you think she isn't strong enough?
Strength has nothing to do with it, but her greatest talents make her unsuited for it in some ways.
I don't understand.
Well, she's good with subtle things, delicate things. Her ability at handling fine, sensitive magic is outstanding and increasing all the time. But that same sensitivity means that she has problems handling the psychic stresses of real combat. It also makes the gross physical stuff a real challenge for her.
Like stopping snowballs, Charity asked.
Snowballs are good practice, I said. Nothing gets hurt but her pride.
Charity nodded, frowning.
But you didn't learn with snowballs, did you? The memory of my first shielding lesson under Justin Dumorne wasn't a particularly sentimental one.
Baseballs?
Merciful God, Charity said, shaking her head.
How old were you?
13, I shrugged a shoulder. Pain's a good motivator. I learned fast.
But you aren't trying to teach my daughter the same way, Charity said.
There's no rush, I said. The noise from the children stopped, dropping to furtive whispers, and I winked at Charity. She glanced from the children to me, amusement evident in her face. Not 5 seconds later, Molly shouted,
Now!
And multiple snowballs came zipping toward me. I lifted my left hand, focused my will, my magic, and drew it into the shape of a broad, flat disc in front of me. It wasn't a good enough shield to stop bullets or even well-thrown baseballs, but for snowballs, it was just fine. They shattered to powder on my shield, revealing it in little flashes of pale blue light as a circular plane of force centered on the outspread fingers of my extended left hand. The children laughed as they cried out their disapproval, and I shouted, Ha! And lifted a triumphant fist. Then Charity, standing behind me, dumped a double handful of snow down the neck of my coat. I yelped as the cold ate my spinal cord, jumped up out of my tracks, and danced around, trying to shake the snow out from under my clothes. The children cheered their mother on and began flinging snowballs at more or less random targets, and in all the excitement and frivolity, I didn't realize that we were under attack until the lights went out. The entire block plunged into darkness, the floodlights illuminating the carpenter's backyard. House lights in every nearby home and street lights were all abruptly extinguished. Eerie, ambient ware light reflected from the snow. Shadows suddenly yawned where there had been none before, and the scent of something midway between a skunk and a barrel of rotting eggs assaulted my nostrils. I yanked my blasting rod out of its holder on the inside of my coat and said to Charity,
Get them inside.
Emergency, Charity said in a far calmer voice than I had managed. Everyone into the safe room, just like in practice. The children had just begun to move when three creatures I had never seen before came bounding through the snow. Time slowed as the adrenaline hit my system, and it felt like I had half an hour to study them. They weren't terribly tall, maybe 5'6", but they were layered with white fur and muscle. Each had a head that was almost goat-like, but the horns atop them curled around to the front like a bull's, rather than arching back. Their legs were reverse-jointed and ended in hooves, and they moved in a series of single-legged leaps more than running. They got better air than a Chicago bull, too, which meant I was dealing with something with supernatural strength. Though thinking about it, I couldn't actually remember the last time I dealt with something that didn't have supernatural strength, which is one of the drawbacks of the wizard business. I mean, some things are stronger than others, sure, but it wouldn't much matter to my skull if a paranormal bruiser could bench press a locomotive, or if he was merely buff enough to juggle refrigerators. I trained the tip of my blasting rod on the lead what's-it, and then a bunch of snow fell from above in my peripheral vision, landing on the ground beside me with a soft thump. I threw myself into a forward dive, rolled over one shoulder, and came to my feet already moving laterally. I was just in time to avoid the rush of a fourth what's-it, which had knocked the snow loose just before it dropped down onto me from the treehouse Michael had built for his kids. It let out a hissing, bubbling snarl. I didn't have time to waste with this backstabbing twit, so I raised the rod as its tip burst into scarlet flame, unleashed my will, and snarled,
Fuego!
A wrist-thick lance of pure flame leapt from the blasting rod and seared the creature's upper body to blackened meat. The excess heat melted snow all around it and sent up a billow of scalding steam. Judging by the tackle hanging between the thing's legs, as the steam burst up from the snow, it probably inflicted as much pain as the actual fire. The Wutsit went down, and I had to hope that it wasn't bright enough to play possum. The Carpenter children were screaming. I whirled around, readying the rod again, and didn't have a clear shot. One of the white-furred creatures was running hard after Daniel, Molly's oldest brother. He'd begun to fill out, and he ran with his fingers locked on the back of the coats of little Harry and Hope, the youngest children, carrying them like luggage. He gained the door, with the creature not 10 feet behind him, its wicked-looking horns lowered as it charged. Daniel went through the door and kicked it shut with his foot, never slowing down, and the creature slammed into it head-on. I hadn't realized that Michael had installed all-steel, wood-paneled security doors on his home, just as I had on mine. The creature probably would have pulverized a wooden door. Instead, it slammed its head into the steel door, horns leading the way, and drove a foot-deep dent into it. And then it lurched away, letting out a burbling shriek of pain. Smoke rose from its horns, and it staggered back, swatting at them with its 3-fingered clawed hands. There weren't many things that reacted to the touch of steel like that. The other two Wutsits had divided their attention. One was pursuing Charity, who was carrying little Amanda and running like hell for the workshop Michael had converted from a freestanding garage. The other was charging Molly, who had pushed Alicia and Matthew behind her. There wasn't time enough to help both groups, and even less to waste over the moral dilemma of a difficult choice. I turned the rod on the beastie chasing Charity and let him have it. The blast hit him in the small of his back and knocked him from his hooves. He flew sideways, slamming into the wall of the workshop, and Charity dashed through the door with her daughter. I turned my blasting rod back to the other creature, but I already knew that I wouldn't be in time. The creature lowered its horns and closed on Molly and her siblings before I could line up for another shot.
"Molly!"
I screamed. My apprentice seized Alicia and Matthew's hands, gasped out a word, and all three of them abruptly vanished. The creature's charge carried it past the space they'd been in, though something I couldn't see struck its hoof and sent it staggering. It wheeled around at full speed, kicking up snow as it did, and I felt a sudden, fierce surge of exultation and pride. The grasshopper might not be able to put up a decent shield, but she could do veils like they were going out of style, and she'd kept her focus and her wits about her. The creature slowed, head sweeping, and then it saw the snow being disturbed by invisible feet moving toward the house. It bawled out another unworldly cry and went after them, and I didn't dare risk another blast of flame, not with the carpenter's house in the line of fire. So instead, I lifted my right hand, triggered one of the triple-layered rings on it with my will, and sent a burst of raw force at the Wutsit. The unseen energy struck it in the knees, throwing its legs out from under it with such strength that its head slammed into the snow. The disturbance in the snow rushed around toward the front door of the house. Molly must have realized that the deformation of the security door would make it difficult, if not impossible, to open, and once again I felt fierce approval. But it faded rather rapidly when the Wutsit that had been playing possum behind me slammed into the small of my back like a sulfur and rotten egg-driven locomotive. The horns hit hard and it hurt like hell, but the defensive magic on my long black leather duster kept them from impaling me. The impact knocked the wind out of me, snapped my head back sharply, and flung me to the snow. Everything got confusing for a second, and then I realized that it was standing over me, ripping at the back of my neck with its claws. I hunched my shoulders and rolled, only to be kicked in the nose by a cloven hoof, and an utterly gratuitous amount of pain came with a side order of whirling stars. I kept trying to get away, but my motions were sluggish, and the Wutsit was faster than me. Charity stepped out of the workshop with a steel hafted ball-peen hammer in her left hand and a heavy-duty contractor's nail gun in her right. She lifted the nail gun from 10 feet away and started pulling the trigger as she walked forward. It made foot-foot-foot sounds, and the already seared Wutsit started screaming in pain. It leapt up wildly, twisting in agonized gyrations in midair, and fell to the snow, thrashing. I saw heavy nails sticking up out of its back, and the smoking wounds were bleeding green-white fire. It tried to run, but I managed to kick its hooves out from under it before it could regain its footing. Charity whirled the hammer in a vertical stroke, letting out a sharp cry as she did, and the steel head of the tool smashed open the Wutsit's skull. The wound erupted with grayish matter and more green-white fire, and the creature twitched once before it went still, its body being consumed by the eerie flame. I stood up, blasting rod still in hand, and found the remaining beasties wounded but mobile, their yellow, rectangular pupiled eyes glaring in hate and hunger. I ditched the blasting rod and picked up a steel-headed snow shovel that had been left lying next to one of the children's snow forts. Charity raised her nail gun, and we began walking toward them. Whatever these things were, they didn't have the stomach for a fight against mortals armed with cold steel. They shuddered as if they'd been a single being, then turned and bounded away into the night. I stood there, panting and peering around me. I had to spit blood out of my mouth every few breaths. My nose felt like someone had superglued a couple of live coals to it. Little silver wires of pain ran all through my neck, from the whiplash of getting hit from behind, and the small of my back felt like one enormous bruise. "Are you all right?" Charity asked. "Fairies," I muttered. "Why did it have to be fairies?"
Chapter 2.
"Well," Charity said, "it's broken."
"You think?"
I asked. The light touch of her fingers on my nose was less than pleasant, but I didn't twitch or make any sounds of discomfort while she examined me. It's a guy thing.
"At least it isn't out of place," Michael said, knocking snow off of his boots. "Getting it set back is the sort of thing you don't mind forgetting."
"Find anything?" I asked him. The big man nodded his head and set a sheathed broadsword in a corner against the wall. Michael was only a couple of inches shorter than me and a lot more muscular. He had dark hair and a short beard, both of them peppered with silver, and wore blue jeans, work boots, and a blue and white flannel shirt.
"That corpse is still there. It's mostly a burned mess, but it didn't dissolve."
"Yeah," I said. "Fairies aren't holy beings of the spirit world. They leave corpses behind." Michael grunted. "Other than that, there were footprints, but that's about it. No sign that these goat things were still around."
He glanced into the dining room, where the carpenter children were gathered at the table, talking excitedly and munching the pizza their father had been out picking up when the attack occurred. "The neighbors think the light show must have come from a blown transformer."
"That's as good an excuse as any," I said. "I thank God no one was hurt," he said.
For him, it wasn't just an expression. He meant it, literally. It came of being a devout Catholic, and maybe from toting around a holy sword with one of the nails from the crucifixion wrought into the blade. He shook himself and gave me a short smile. "And you, of course, Harry."
"Thank Daniel, Molly, and Charity," I said. "I just kept our visitors busy. Your family is who got the little ones to safety, and Charity did all the actual smiting."
Michael's eyebrows went up, and he turned his gaze on his wife.
"Did she now?"
Charity's cheeks turned pink. She briskly swept up the various tissues and cloths I'd bloodied, and carried them out of the room to be burned in the lit fireplace in the living room. In my business, you don't ever want samples of your blood, your hair, or your fingernail clippings lying around for someone else to find. I gave Michael the rundown of the fight while she was gone.
"My nail gun?"
he asked, grinning, as Charity came back into the kitchen.
"How did you know it was a fairy?"
"I didn't," she said. "I just grabbed what was at hand."
"We got lucky," I said.
Michael arched an eyebrow at me. I scowled at him.
"Not every good thing that happens is divine intervention, Michael."
"True," Michael said.
"But I prefer to give him the credit unless I have a good reason to believe otherwise. It seems more polite than the other way around."
Charity came to stand at her husband's side. Though they were both smiling and speaking lightly about the attack, I noticed that they were holding hands very tightly, and Charity's eyes kept drifting over toward the children, as if to reassure herself that they were still there and safe. I suddenly felt like an intruder.
"Well," I said, rising, "looks like I've got a new project."
Michael nodded.
"Do you know the motive for the attack?"
"That's the project," I said. I pulled my duster on, wincing as the motion made me move my stiffening neck.
"I think they were after me.
The attack on the kids was a diversion to give the one in the tree a shot at my back."
"Are you sure about that?" Charity asked quietly.
"No," I admitted. "It's possible that they're holding a grudge about that business at Arctis Tor." Charity's eyes narrowed and went steely.
Arctis Tor was the heart of the Winter Court, the fortress and sanctum sanctorum of Queen Mab herself. Some nasty customers from Winter had stolen Molly, and Charity and I, with a little help, had stormed the tower and taken Molly back by main force. The whole mess had been noisy as hell, and we'd pissed off an entire nation of wicked fae in the process of making it.
"Keep your eyes open, just in case," I told her. "And let Molly know that I'd like her to stay here for the time being."
Michael quirked an eyebrow at me.
"You think she needs our protection?"
"No," I said. "I think you might need hers." Michael blinked. Charity frowned quietly, but did not dispute me. I nodded to both of them and left. Molly wasn't rebelling against everything I told her to do purely upon reflex these days, but fait accompli remained the best way of avoiding arguments with her. I shut the door to the Carpenter household behind me, cutting off the scent of hot pizza and the sound of loudly animated children's voices, raucous after the excitement. The November night was silent and very cold. I fought off an urge to shiver and hurried to my car, a beat-up old Volkswagen Beetle that had originally been powder blue, but was now a mix of red, blue, green, white, yellow, and now primer gray on the new hood my mechanic had scrounged up. Some anonymous joker who had seen too many Disney movies had spray-painted the number 53 inside a circle on the hood, but the car's name was the Blue Beetle, and it was going to stay that way. I sat looking at the warm golden light coming from the house for a moment, then I coaxed the beetle to life and headed for home. Chapter 3.
"And you're sure there were fairies?" Bob the Skull asked.
I scowled. "How many other things get their blood set on fire when it touches iron and steel, Bob? Yes, I think I know a fairy when I get my nose broken by one." I was down in my lab, which was accessed by means of a trapdoor in my basement apartment's living room and a folding wooden stepladder. It's a concrete box of a room, deep enough under the rest of the boarding house I live in to be perpetually cool. In the summer, that's nice. Come winter, not so much. The lab consisted of a wooden table running down the center of the room and was surrounded on three sides by tables and workbenches against the outer wall of the room, leaving a narrow walkway around the table. The workbenches were littered with the tools of the trade, and I'd installed those white wire shelving units you can get pretty cheap at Walmart on the walls above the benches, creating more storage space. The shelves were covered with an enormous variety of containers, from a lead-lined box to burlap bags, from Tupperware to a leather pouch made from the genital sac of, I kid you not, an actual African lion. It was a gift, don't ask. Candles burned around the room, giving it light and twinkling off the pewter miniature buildings on the center table, a scale model of the city of Chicago. I brought down a single writing desk for Molly, all the room I had to spare, and her own notebooks and slowly accumulating collection of gear managed to stay neatly organized despite the tiny space.
"Well, it looks like someone is holding Arctis Tor against you," Bob said.
The skull, its eye sockets glowing with orange flickers of light like candles you couldn't quite see, sat on its own shelf on the uncluttered wall. Half a dozen paperback romance novels littered the shelf around it, and a seventh had fallen from the shelf and now lay on the floor, obscuring a portion of the silver summoning circle I'd installed there.
"Fairies don't ever forget a grudge, boss."
I shook my head at the skull, scooped up the fallen book and put it back on the shelf. "You ever heard of anything like these guys?"
"My knowledge of the fairy realms is mostly limited to the winter end of things," Bob said. "These guys don't sound like anything I've run into."
"Then why would they be holding the fight at Arctis Tor against me, Bob?" I asked. "Hell, we weren't even the ones who really assaulted Winter's capital. We just walked in on the aftermath and picked a fight with some of Winter's errand boys who had swiped Molly."
"Maybe some of the Winter She hired out the Vengeance gig as contract labor. These could have been wild fae, you know. There's a lot more wild than anything else. They could have been satyrs."
His eyelights brightened.
"Did you see any nymphs? If there are satyrs, there's bound to be a nymph or two somewhere close."
"No, Bob."
"Are you sure? Naked girl, drop-dead gorgeous, old enough to know better and young enough not to care?"
"I'd have remembered that if I'd seen it," I said.
"Feh," Bob said, his eyelights dwindling in disappointment. "You can't do anything right, Harry."
I rubbed my hand against the back of my neck. It didn't make it hurt any less, but it gave me something to do. I've seen these goat guys, or read about them before, I said. Or at least something close to them. Where did I put those texts on the near reaches of the Never Never?
North wall, green plastic box under the workbench, Bob provided immediately.
Thanks, I said. I dragged out the heavy plastic storage box. It was filled with books, most of them leather-bound, handwritten treatises on various supernatural topics, except for one book that was a compilation of Calvin and Hobbes comic strips. How had that gotten in there? I picked up several of the books, carried them to the part of the table that was modeled as Lake Michigan, and set them down. Then I pulled up my stool and started flipping through them.
How was the trip to Dallas? Bob asked.
Fine. Someone was being stalked by a black dog. I glanced up at the map of the United States hanging on the wall beneath Bob's shelf on a thick piece of poster board. I absently plucked a green thumbtack from the board and poked it into Dallas, Texas, where it joined more than a dozen other green pins and a very few red ones where the false alarms had been. They contacted me through the Paranet, and I showed them how to give Fido the bum's rush out of town.
This support network thing you and Elaine have going is really smart, Bob said. Teach the minnows how to gang up when the big fish shows up to eat them.
I prefer to think of it as teaching sparrows to band together and chase off hawks, I said, returning to my seat.
Either way, it means less exposure to danger and less work for you in the long run.
Constructive cowardice. Very crafty, I approve. His voice turned wistful.
I hear they have some of the best strip clubs in the world in Dallas, Harry.
I gave Bob a hard look. If you're not gonna help me, at least don't distract me.
Oh, Bob said. Check.
The romance I had put back on the shelf quivered for a second, and then flipped over and opened to the first page. The skull turned toward the book, the orange light from its eyes falling over the pages. I went through one old text, then two, then three. Hell's bells, I knew I'd seen or read something in one of these.
Rip her dress off! Bob shouted.
Bob the Skull takes paperback romances very seriously. The next page turns so quickly that he tore the paper a little. Bob is even harder on books than I am.
That's what I'm talking about!
Bob hollered as more pages turned. It couldn't have been Satyrs, I mumbled out loud, trying to draw my thoughts into order. My nose hurt like hell, and my neck hurt like someplace in the same zip code. That kind of pain wears you down fast, even when you're a wizard who learned his basics while being violently bombarded with baseballs. Satyrs have human faces. These things didn't.
Weregoats?
Bob suggested. He flipped another page and kept reading. Bob is a spirit of intellect, and he multitasks better than, well, pretty much anybody.
Or maybe goat wares.
I stopped for a moment and gave the skull an exasperated look.
I can't believe I just heard that word.
What? Bob asked brightly.
Weregoats?
Weregoats. I'm fairly sure I could have led a perfectly rich and satisfying life even if I hadn't heard that word or enjoyed the mental images it conjures. Bob chortled.
Stars and stones. You're easy, Harry.
Weregoats, I muttered, and went back to reading. After finishing the fifth book, I went back for another armload. Bob shouted at his book, cheering during what were apparently the love scenes, and heckling most of the rest, as if the characters had all been live performers on stage. Which would probably tell me something important about Bob, if I were an astute sort of person. After all, Bob himself was essentially a spiritual creature, created from the energy of thought. The characters within a book were, from a certain point of view, identical on some fundamental level. There weren't any images of them, no physical tangibility whatsoever. They were pictures in the reader's head, constructs of imagination and ideas, given shape by the writer's work and skill and the reader's imagination. Parents, of a sort. Did Bob, as he read his books and imagined their events, regard those constructed beings as siblings of some sort? Peers? Children? Could a being like Bob develop some kind of acquired taste for a family? It was entirely possible. It might explain his constant fascination with fictional subject matter dealing with the origins of a mortal family. Then again, he might regard the characters in the same way some men do those inflatable sex dolls. I was pretty sure I didn't want to know. Good thing I'm not astute. I found our attackers in the 8th book, about halfway through, complete with notes and sketches. Holy crap, I muttered, sitting up straight.
Find them?
Bob asked. Yeah, I said, and held up the book so he could see the sketch. It was a better match for our goatish attackers than most police sketches of perpetrators. If the book is right, I just got jumped by gruffs. Bob's romance novel dropped to the surface of the shelf. He made a choking sound.
Did you say gruffs?
I scowled at him, and he began to giggle. The skull rattled against the shelf.
Gruffs?
He tittered.
What?
I said, offended.
As in the 3 billy goats, Gruff?
The skull howled with laughter.
You just got your ass handed to you by a nursery tale.
I wouldn't say they handed me my ass, I said. Bob was nearly strangling on his laughter, and given that he had no lungs, it seemed gratuitous somehow.
That's because you can't see yourself, he choked out. Your nose is all swollen up and you've got 2 black eyes. You look like a raccoon holding a dislocated ass.
You didn't see these things in action, I said. They were strong and pretty smart, and there were 4 of them.
Just like the 4 horsemen, he said, only with petting zoos.
I scowled some more. Fine, fine, I said. I'm glad I can amuse you.
Oh, absolutely, Bob said, his voice bubbling with mirth. Help me, help me, it's the billy goat's gruff.
I glared. You're missing the point, Bob.
It can't be as funny as what's come through, he said. I bet every she in winter is giggling about it.
I bet they're not, I said. That's the point. The gruffs work for summer, as some of Queen Titania's enforcers. Bob's laughter died abruptly.
Oh.
I nodded. After that business at Arctis Tor, I could understand if someone from winter had come after me. I never figured to do this kind of business with summer.
Well, Bob pointed out, you did kind of give Queen Titania's daughter the death of 1,000 cuts.
I grunted. Yeah, but why send hitters now? She could have done it years ago.
That's fairies for you, Bob said. Logic isn't exactly their strong suit.
I grunted. Life should be so simple. I thumped my finger on the book, thinking, there's more to this. I'm sure of it.
How high are they in the summer hierarchy? Bob asked.
They're up there, I said. As a group, anyway. They've got a reputation for killing trolls. Probably where the nursery tale comes from.
Troll killers, Bob said. Trolls? Like Mab's personal guard? Whose pieces you found scattered all over Arctis Tor?
Exactly, I said. But what I did there ticked off winter, not summer.
I've always admired your ability to be unilaterally irritating.
I shook my head. No. I must have done something there that hurt summer somehow, I frowned. Or helped winter.
Bob, do you know—
The phone started ringing. I had run a long extension cord from the outlet in my bedroom down to the lab, after Molly had nearly broken her neck rushing up the stepladder to answer a call. The old wind-up clock on one shelf told me that it was after midnight. Nobody calls me that late, unless it's something bad. Hold that thought, I told Bob.
It's me, Murphy said when I answered. I need you.
Why, Sergeant, I'm touched, I said. You've admitted the truth at last. Cue sweeping romantic theme music.
I'm serious, she said.
Something in her voice sounded tired, strained.
Where?
I asked her. She gave me the address and we hung up. I barely ever got work from Chicago PD anymore, and between that and my frequent trips to other cities as part of my duties as a warden, I hadn't been making diddly as an investigator. My stipend as a warden of the White Council kept me from bankruptcy, but my bank account had bled slowly down to the point where I had to be really careful to avoid bouncing checks. I needed the work.
That was Murphy, I said, making a duty call. This late at night, what else could it be?
Bob agreed.
Watch your back extra careful, boss.
Why did you say that? I said, shrugging into my coat.
I don't know if you're up on your nursery tales, Bob said, but if you'll remember, the billy goat's gruff had a whole succession of brothers.
Yeah, I said, each of them bigger and meaner than the last. I headed out to meet Murphy. Weregoats. Jesus. Chapter 4. I was standing there watching the fire with everyone else when the beat cop brought Murphy over to me.
It's about time, she said, her voice tense.
She lifted the police tape and beckoned me. I had already clipped my little laminated consultant's ID to my duster's lapel.
What took you so long?
There's a foot of snow on the ground, and it doesn't show signs of stopping, I replied. She glanced up at me. Karen Murphy is a wee little thing, and the heavy winter coat she wore only made her look smaller. The large, fluffy snowflakes still falling clung to her golden hair and glittered on her eyelashes, turning her eyes glacial blue.
Your toy car got stuck in a drift, huh? What happened to your face?
I glanced around at all the normals.
I was in a snowball fight.
Murphy grunted.
I guess you lost.
You should have seen the other guy. We were standing in front of a small five-story apartment building, and something had blown it to hell. The front facing of the building was just gone, as if some unimaginably huge axe had sliced straight down it. You could see the floors and interiors of empty apartments when you could get a glimpse of them through the pall of dust and smoke and thick falling snow. Fires burned in the building, insubstantial behind the haze of flame and winter. Rubble had washed out into the street, damaging the buildings on the other side, and the police had everyone cordoned off at least a block away. Broken glass and steel and brick lay everywhere. The air was acrid, thick with the stench of burning materials never meant to feed a fire. Despite the weather, a couple of hundred people had gathered at the police cordons. Some enterprising soul was selling hot coffee from a big thermos, and I hadn't been too proud to cough up a dollar for a foam cup of Java, powdered creamer, and a packet of sugar.
Lots of fire trucks, I noted,
but only one ambulance. And the crew is drinking coffee while everyone else shivers in the cold. I sipped at my cup. The bastards.
Building wasn't occupied, Murphy said. Being renovated, actually.
No one got hurt, I said. That's a plus. Murphy gave me a cryptic look. You willing to work off the books, per diem? I sipped coffee to cover up a wince. I far prefer a 2-day minimum.
I guess the city isn't coughing up much money for consultants, huh?
SI's been pooling the coffee money in case we needed your take on something. This time I didn't bother to hide the wince. Taking money from the city government was one thing. Taking money from the cops and SI was another. Special Investigations was the CPD's version of a pool filter. Things that slipped through the areas of interest of the other departments got dumped on SI. Lots of times those things included the cruddy work no one else wanted to do. So SI wound up investigating everything from apparent reigns of toads to dog-fighting rackets to reports of El Chupacabra molesting neighborhood pets from its lair in a local sewer. It was a crappy job, no pun intended. And as a result, SI was regarded by the city as a kind of asylum for incompetence. They weren't, but the inmates of SI generally did share a couple of traits. Intelligence, enough to ask questions when something didn't make sense, and an inexcusable lack of ability when it came to navigating the murky waters of office politics. When Sergeant Murphy had been Lieutenant Murphy, she'd been in charge of SI. She'd been busted for vanishing during 24 particularly critical hours of an investigation. It wasn't like she could tell her superiors that she was off storming a frozen fortress in the near reaches of the Never Never, now could she? Now, her old partner, Lieutenant John Stallings, was in charge of SI, and he was running the place on a strained, frayed, often knotted shoestring of a budget. Hence the lack of gainful employment for Chicago's only professional wizard. I couldn't take their money. It wasn't like they were rolling in it. But at the same time, they had their pride. I couldn't take that either.
Per diem? I told her.
Hell, my bank account's thinner than a tobacco lobbyist's moral justification. I'll go hourly. Murphy glowered up at me for a moment, then gave me a grudging nod of thanks. Proud doesn't always outweigh practical.
So what's the scoop? I asked.
Arson? She shrugged.
Explosion of some kind. Maybe an accident, maybe not.
I snorted.
Yeah, because you call me in on maybe accidents all the time.
Come on. Murphy pulled a dust mask from her coat pocket and put it on. I took out a bandana and tied it around my nose and mouth. All I needed was a 10-gallon hat and some spurs to complete the image. Stick 'em up, partner. She glanced back at me, her face hard to read under the desk mask, and led me to the building adjacent to the ruined apartment. Murphy's partner was waiting for us. Rawlins was a blocky man in his 50s. comfortably overweight, and looked about as soft as a Brinks truck. He'd grown in a beard frosted with gray, a sharp contrast against his dark skin, and he wore a weather-beaten old winter coat over his off-the-rack suit.
Dresden, he said easily. Good to see you.
I shook his hand. How's the foot?
It aches when I'm about to get asked to leave, he said soberly.
How? It's better if you've got deniability, Murphy said, folding her arms in what an astute observer might have characterized as a tone of stubborn argument. You've got a family to feed. Rollins sighed.
Yeah, I'll be out by the street.
He nodded to me and walked off. He'd recovered from being shot in the foot pretty well and wasn't limping. Good for him. Good for me, too. I'd been the one to get him into that mess.
Deniability? I asked Murphy.
There hasn't been anything specific, Murphy said. But people up the line from SI have made it very clear that you are persona non grata.
That stung a bit, and my voice turned a shade more brittle than I had intended.
Oh, obviously. The way I keep helping CPD with things they couldn't handle themselves is just inexcusable.
I know, Murphy said.
I'm lucky they haven't charged me with gross competence and contributing to social order and had me locked away.
She waved a tired, dismissive hand.
It's always something. That's the way organizations are.
Except that when the country club gets a bug up its nose and decides that someone is out, nobody dies as a result, I said, and added, mostly. Murphy glared at me.
What do you want me to do about it, Harry? I called in every chip I'd ever collected just to keep my fucking job. There's no chance at all of me making command again, much less moving up to a position where I could effect real change within the department.
I clenched my jaw and felt a flush rising up my neck. She hadn't said it, but she'd lost her command and any bright future for her career because she'd been covering my back.
Murph.
No, she said, her tone calmer and steadier than it might have been. I'd really like you to know, Dresden. I've paid you out of my own pocket when the city wouldn't spend it. The rest of SI throws in all the money they can spare into the kitty to be able to pay you when we really need you. You think maybe I should moonlight at a burger joint to pay your fees?
Hell's bells, Murph, I said. It isn't about the money. It's never been about the money.
She shrugged.
So what are you bitching about?
I thought about it for a second and said,
you shouldn't have to tap dance around the demands of all the ladder climbers to do your job.
No, she said, her tone frank. Not in a reasonable world. But if you haven't noticed, that world must be in a different area code. And it seems to me that you've had to end run your superiors once or twice.
Bah, I said.
And touche. She smiled faintly.
It sucks, but that's what we've got. You done whining?
Hell with it, I said. Let's work. Murphy jerked her head at the rubble-choked alley between the damaged building and its neighbor, and we started down it, climbing over fallen brick and timber where necessary. We'd gone about 3 feet before the stench of sulfur and acrid brimstone seared my nostrils, sharp even through the smell of the gutted apartment building. There's only one thing that smells like that.
Crap, I muttered. I thought it smelled familiar, Murphy said, like back at the fortress.
She glanced at me.
And the other times I've smelled it.
I pretended not to notice her glance.
Yeah, it's hellfire, I said.
There's more, Murphy said quietly. Come on.
We pressed on down the alley until we passed the edge of the wrecked portion of the gutted building. One step, there was nothing but wreckage. The next, the brick wall of the building reasserted itself. The demarcation between structure and havoc was a rough, jagged line stretching up into the dust and the snow and the smoke, all except for a portion of wall perhaps 5 feet off the ground. There, instead of a broken line of shattered brick and twisted rebar, a perfectly smooth semicircle bit into the wall. I leaned closer, frowning. The scent of hellfire grew stronger, and I realized that something had melted its way through the brick wall. A shaft of energy like a giant drill bit. It had to have been almost unimaginably hot to vaporize brick and concrete and steel, leaving the rim of the area it had touched melted to smooth glass. Though half of the basketball-sized circle was missing, carried away by the collapsing wall. Any natural source of heat like that would have sent out a thermal bloom that would have scoured the alley I was standing in, leaving it blackened and sere. But the alley was littered with the usual city detritus, where it wasn't choked with rubble, and several hours' worth of snow had piled up there as well.
Talk to me,
Murphy said quietly.
No normal fire is this contained, I said.
What do you mean?
I gestured vaguely with my hands.
Fire, generated with magic, is still fire, Murph. I mean, sure, you can call up tremendous heat and energy, but once it gets to you, it behaves like heat. It still does business with the laws of thermodynamics.
So we're talking mojo, Murphy said.
Well, technically mojo isn't,
she sighed.
Are we dealing with magic or not?
As if the scent of hellfire weren't enough to give it away.
Yeah.
Murphy nodded.
You call up fire all the time, she said. I've seen it do a lot of things that didn't look like normal fire.
Well, sure, I said, holding my hand over the surface of the flame-bored bricks. They were still warm.
But if you want to control it once you call it up, it takes additional energy to focus the fire into a desired course. Controlling the energy is usually as much effort as the fire itself, if not more.
Could you do something like this? She asked, gesturing at the building.
Once upon a time, she would have inflected that question a whole lot differently, and I'd have gotten nervous about whether the hands in her pockets were holding a gun and handcuffs. But that had been a long time ago. Of course, back then, I probably wouldn't have given her a straight answer either, like I would now.
Not a chance in hell, I said quietly, and not entirely metaphorically. I'm pretty sure I couldn't call up this much energy in the first place, and even if I could, I wouldn't have anything left to control it with.
I closed my eyes for a moment, trying to feel any lingering traces of power around the area, but the destruction and subsequent drift of dust and snow and smoke had obscured any coherent patterns that might have given me hints about how the working had been accomplished. I did, however, notice something else. The surface of the cut was not perpendicular to the wall of the building. It went in at an angle. I frowned and squinted back behind me, trying to line it up with the wall of the building on the other side of the alley. Murphy knew me well enough to see I'd noticed something, and I knew her well enough to see her sudden interest make furrows between her eyebrows as she forced herself to be quiet and let me work. I got up and went to the far side of the alley. A light coating of snow and dust had coated the wall. "Watch your eyes," I murmured, squinting my own to slits. Then I raised my right hand, calling up my will, and murmured,
Ventus reductus.
The wind I called up wasn't the usual burst I commonly used. It was far more toned down than that, and it poured steadily from my outstretched hand. All the work I was doing with Molly had allowed me to rethink a lot of my basic evocations, the fast and dirty magic that wizards used in desperate and violent situations. I had been trying to teach the spell to Molly, but she didn't have the raw strength I had, and would have practically knocked her unconscious to call up a heavy blast of air. I had modified my teaching, just to get her comfortable with using a bit of air magic, and we'd accidentally developed a passable impersonation of an electric blow dryer. I used the dryer spell to gently brush away dust and snow from the wall. It took me about a minute and a half, and when I was finished, I caught another scent under the brimstone stench and said, Double crap. Murphy stepped forward with her flashlight and shone it on the wall. The sigil had been painted on the wall in something thick and brown that smelled like blood. At first I thought it was a pentacle, but I saw the differences immediately.
Harry, Murphy said quietly, is it human?
Most likely, I said. Mortal blood is the strongest ink you can use for symbols like this in high-energy spells. I don't think anything else could have contained the amount of energy it would have taken to blow up this building.
It's a pentacle, right? Murphy asked. Like the one you wear?
I shook my head.
Different.
How so? Her mouth twitched at one corner. Other than the blood, I mean.
A pentacle is a symbol of order, I said quietly. 5 points, 5 sides. It represents the forces of air, earth, water, fire, and spirit. It's contained within a circle, the points touching the outer ring. It represents the forces of magic bound within human control. Power balanced with restraint.
I gestured at the symbol. See here? The points of the star fall far outside the ring. She frowned.
What does it mean?
I have no idea, I said.
Gosh, she said, you're worth the money.
Ha ha. Look, even if I'd seen the symbol before, it could mean different things to different people. The Hindus and the Nazis have very different ideas about the swastika, for example.
Can you make a guess?
I shrugged.
Off the top of my head?
This looks uncomfortably like a combination of the pentacle and the anarchy symbol.
Magic unrestrained. Anarchist wizards? Murphy asked.
It's just a guess, I said. My gut told me it was a good one, though, and I got the impression that Murphy had the same feeling.
What's the symbol for? Murphy asked. What is it meant to do?
Reflect power, I said. My guess is that the energy that drove through the building was reflected from the sigil, which means... I kayaked down a logic cascade as I spoke. Which means that the energy had to come in from somewhere else first.
I turned around slowly, trying to judge the angles. The incoming beam must have gone right through the collapsed part of the building and...
Beam?
I pointed to the semicircular hole in the ruined wall.
Yeah, heat energy. A whole lot of it.
She studied the hole.
It doesn't look like it would be big enough to take down the building.
It isn't, I said. Not in an explosion, anyway. This just drilled a hole. Might have started a fire as it went, but it couldn't have sheared off the front of the building like that.
Murphy frowned, tilting her head.
Then what did?
Working on it, I mumbled.
I judged the angles as best I could and took off down the alley. The firemen were still hard at work on the building, and we had to walk over several hoses as we emerged into the street at the back of the apartment building. I crossed the street and walked down the length of the building there, my hand raised, senses questing for any residual magic. I didn't find any, but I did smell hellfire again. And a couple of feet later, I found another knot pentacle, identical to the first, also hidden under a light dusting of snow. I kept going clockwise around the ruined building. I found two more symbols on the undamaged building on its next side, and one more across the street from the front of the ruined apartments. And then I completed the circle, arriving back at our original reflective symbol. Five reflection points, which had guided a truly freaking, frightening amount of energy through the building, forming one single, enormous shape as they did.
It's a pentagram, I said quietly.
Murphy frowned.
What?
I touched the round, smooth bore mark on the destroyed building's wall. The beam of energy that ripped through the building right here was one of five sides of a pentagram, a five-pointed star. Murphy regarded me blankly. I reached into my pocket and pulled out a piece of chalk.
Okay, look.
Everyone learns to draw this in grade school, right? I quickly sketched out a star on a clear bit of brick wall, five strokes of the chalk forming 5 points. Right?
Right,
Murphy said. You get them from the teacher when you get an A. Another example of symbols having disparate meanings, I said. But look here, in the middle. I filled in the closed shape in the center of the star. That's a pentagon shape, see? The center of the pentagram. That's where you contain whatever it is you're trying to contain.
What do you mean, contain?
A pentagram like this one is a symbol of power, I said. It's got lots of uses, depending on how you employ it. But most often you use it to isolate or contain an entity.
You mean like summoning a demon, Murphy said.
Sure, I said, but you can use it to trap other things too, if you do it right. Remember the circle of power at Harley McFinn's place? 5 candles formed the pentagram on that one.
Murphy shuddered. I remember, but it wasn't this big.
No, I admitted. And the bigger you make it, the more juice it takes to keep going. I have never, ever heard of one that would take this much energy to activate. I drew little X shapes at the points of the star and drew the chalk from one to the next, thickening the lines of the example pentagram. Get it? The beam streamed from one reflector to the next, melting holes through the building as it went. The reflectors formed a beam into one huge pentagram at ground level, more or less. Murphy frowned and squinted at the simple diagram.
The center of that shape couldn't have covered the whole building.
No, I said. I'd need a good map to be sure, but I think the center of the pentagram must have been about 20 feet back from the front door, which is why only the front half of the building collapsed. The explosion came from inside this pentagon thing? Magical TNT? I shrugged. The explosion came from inside the pentagram's center, but not necessarily from the pentagram. I mean, it could have been a normal device of some kind.
Square in the middle of the giant, scary pentagram? Murphy asked.
Maybe, I said, nodding. It depends on what the pentagram was being employed for. And to know that, I'd have to know which way was its north. I circled the topmost point of the chalk pentacle. The direction of the first line, I mean.
Does it make a difference?
Yeah, I said. Most everybody draws those stars just like I did. Bottom left to the topmost point is the first stroke. That's how you draw it when you want to defend something,
ward something away from a location, or banish a spiritual entity.
So this could have been a banishing spell, Murphy asked.
It's possible, but you can do a lot of other things with it if you draw it differently.
Like build a cage for things, Murphy said.
Yeah, I frowned, troubled. Or open a doorway for something.
Which, judging by your face, would be bad.
I shook my head. I didn't even want to know what kind of terror would need a pentagram that huge in order to squeeze into our world. I think if something sized to fit this pentagram had come through it, there would probably be more than one building on fire.
Oh, Murphy said quietly.
Look, until I know what the pentagram's purpose was, all I can do is speculate. And there's something else weird here, too.
What's that?
There's not a trace of residual magic, and there should be.
Hell, with this much power being tossed around, the whole area should practically be glowing.
It isn't.
Murphy nodded slowly.
You're saying they wiped their prints.
I grimaced.
Exactly.
And I have no idea how to do it. Hell's bells, I didn't know it was possible.
I sipped at my coffee in the silence and pretended the shiver that went down my spine was from the cold. I passed the cup to Murphy, who took a sip from the opposite side, and passed it back to me.
So, she said, we're left with questions. What is a major league supernatural hitter doing placing a huge pentagram under an empty apartment building? What was his goal in creating it?
And why blow up the building afterward? I frowned and thought of an even better question. Why this building?
I turned to Murphy.
Who owns it?
Lake Michigan Ventures, Murphy replied. Subsidiary of Mitigation Unlimited, whose CEO is
triple crap, I spat.
Gentleman Johnny Marcone.
Chapter 5. I tried to collect some of the blood in the reflective symbols and use it in a tracking spell to follow it back to the original owner, but it was a bust. Either the blood was already too dry to use, or else the person who had donated it was dead. I had a bad feeling that it wasn't the winter air that made the spell fail.
Typical. Nothing was ever simple when Marcone was involved.
Gentleman Johnny Marcone was the robber baron of the streets of Chicago and the undisputed lord of its criminal underworld. Though he'd long been under legal siege, the bastions of paperwork defended by legions of lawyers had never been conquered, and his power base had grown steadily and quietly. They probably could have tried harder to take him down, but the heartless fact of the matter was that Marcone's management style was a better alternative than most. He put the civil back in civil offender, harshly cutting down on violence against civilians and law enforcement alike. It didn't make his business any less ugly, just tidier, and it could have been worse, as far as the city's authorities were concerned. Of course, the authorities didn't know that it was worse. Marcone had begun expanding his power base into the supernatural world as well, signing on to the Unseelie Accords as a freeholding lord. It made him, in the eyes of the authorities of the supernatural world, a kind of small, neutral state, a recognizable power, and I had no doubt that he'd begun using that new power to do what he always did, create more of the same.
All of which had been made possible by Harry Dresden. And the truly galling thing about the entire situation was that it had been the least evil of the options that had been available to me at the time. I looked up from the circle I chalked on the concrete beneath the sheltering overhang in the alley and shook my head.
Sorry, can't get anything. Maybe the blood's too dry, maybe the donor's dead.
Murphy nodded.
I'll keep an eye on the morgues then. I broke the circle with a swipe of my hand and rose from my knees.
Can I ask you something? Murphy said.
Sure.
Why don't you ever use pentagrams? All I ever see you draw is circles.
I shrugged. PR mostly. Run around making lots of five-pointed stars in this country and people start screaming about Satan, including the Satanists. I've got enough problems. If I need a pentagram, I usually just imagine it.
You can do that?
Magic's in your head, mostly. Building an image in your mind and holding it there. Theoretically, you could do everything without any chalk or symbols or anything else.
Then why don't you?
Because it's a pointlessly difficult effort for identical results.
I squinted up at the still falling snow.
You're a cop. I need a donut.
She snorted as we left the alley.
Stereotype much, Dresden? Cops do a lot of running around in their cars, and they don't always get to control their hours, Murph. Lots of times they can't leave a crime scene to hit a drive-through. so they need food that can sit in a car for hours and hours without tasting foul or giving them food poisoning. Donuts are good for that.
So are granola bars.
Is Rawlins a masochist, too?